I thought this morning that just to help you all feel at home, not too many changes, that I might do my message as a 20-minute political advertisement. Oh, okay. All right. Maybe not. Maybe not. Over the last several weeks, we have been thinking together about the theme of radical hospitality. And I'm hoping that this theme has begun to be something kind of like a frame around your experiences and your daily interactions, that because of this frame of hospitality that we've been thinking about, that you've maybe been noticing some opportunities, and the colors of hospitality have been emerging to you, and the opportunities for this extending of the gift of hospitality to others. This morning, though, well, if I had a quarter, I would use it, but I don't seem to have many of those now that I have children. If I had a quarter, I would take it out, and I would flip it over, and I would say, to this point in the journey, we've been speaking about one side of the coin. And this morning, I want to talk about the flip side of the coin of hospitality. We've been talking mostly about extending hospitality to others, and this morning, I would like to speak about receiving hospitality. And I'd like to ask you to picture an experience that I had in 2005. In 2005, as many of you know, I had the opportunity to fly to a country called Myanmar, which is clear over on the other side of the world. It boundaries China on one side, and Bangladesh, and Thailand, and this country used to be called Burma. And I was in Myanmar for a retreat with two other church leaders, one from Ohio and another one from Oregon, who were teaching students from Myanmar about the good news of Jesus, a week-long retreat for students in the largest city of Myanmar called Yangon. We spent the first week there teaching these students in a situation that the only word that comes to mind is sultry. I never had experienced humidity in all of my life until I was in Burma. And we spent our first week together with these students in this extraordinary setting in Yangon, Myanmar. And then the second purpose of our trip was to see the work of the Church of God around the country. So we got in a van and we drove out of Yangon, the largest city of Myanmar, and we went out to some of the rural areas where the Church of God has planted churches in various places around the country. And I learned what many of you have learned in your travels to places like Honduras, and that is that the greatest poverty of many of the third world countries, developing world countries, is not in the cities. It's in the rural communities. And as we traveled further and further away from Yangon, we saw things that were unlike anything that I had ever seen before, extraordinary challenges that people live with. And we saw little churches, usually homes, that the Church of God had purchased, and people from around a neighborhood would come together and they would worship in this home. And we had spent a day looking at the work of the church in the rural areas of the country, and we were driving back now toward Yangon in our van, and we were moving toward the city, and we were now kind of in that in-between space, in between rural and city. And our leader, our host pastor, Dorothy Colney, told us that she had arranged for a family in the church to meet with us at their home on our way back. So our little van pulled up at this little home, and I've actually got some photos for you that I'm hoping will help you to picture this. If you would pull up the first one of those photos, I hope you've got that available. This is the kitchen of this little home that we stopped to visit. This was a little outdoor workstation. I don't know what they do when it's the rainy season, but this was the kitchen of this little family that we were stopping to meet with. And this next picture is a photo of the house. Let's go forward one more, if we could, to the next one. This is the house itself. And this photo really doesn't do justice to this little tiny house in which, as it turned out, three generations were living. It's been a while now, but my memory wants to tell me that it was 12 people who were living under this extraordinarily tiny, tiny house. It's up on stilts to protect it from the rainy season, not a foundation, but up on stilts. And as I walked toward this house, I noticed that there was a little piece of paper that was posted on the wall. You can see some papers posted on the wall behind there. You can't see this particular one. It was It was curious to me. I could see that there were columns. They were written in Burmese, so I can hardly read English, so I certainly couldn't read this. Something written in Burmese, and then something that looked like numbers in the column next to it. And out of curiosity, I asked our host, what is this piece of paper? And my host explained to me that this family couldn't afford to pay for their utilities more than one day at a time. And so each day, a different adult, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, would take their income from their work and they would walk to the utility company and they would pay the amount in the column next to it to pay for their utilities for that day. So this was the family. Would you go back for just a second to the little girl? I just want you to see how they dolled up this little gal to greet us as we arrived at her house. So here are three of us from the United States meeting together with this family of roughly 12 or so people in this extraordinarily tiny, tiny, tiny house. And as we were seated, they brought to each one of us an orange soda. And at first, that may not strike you as extraordinary, but as I looked at this house, and I thought of 12 people living in this home, and I thought of a different adult going every day to pay the utility payment for that day because they couldn't afford to pay for 2 days at a time. And I looked at this orange soda, and I realized we were the only three in the group to whom the orange soda was given. And it became immediately apparent to me that this was an extravagant gift that was being laid in our hands. I was really troubled by this. I'm sitting here with an orange soda in my hand. That is, I have no idea how much an orange soda in Myanmar costs, but I suspect more than they could afford to get for themselves. And I'm seated in a chair with two other leaders from the United States for whom this is pocket change, and I'm imagining how in the world I am supposed to receive this gift from these people. Now, I have a theory, and my theory, not very scientific. My theory is that about 90% of us who are in this gathering this morning find it more difficult to receive hospitality than we do to give it. As I look around this group, I see people who are extravagantly generous with their time and their energy and their gifts and their hospitality. I'm looking at a group of people who are just extraordinary. And my hunch is that in this gathering, 90% of us find it easier to extend hospitality to others than we do to welcome it. I think there are probably several reasons for that. One of them I've alluded to already in the telling of my story from Myanmar, and that is we're concerned about putting other people out. It troubles us that others might go to a great cost or a great expense of time and energy on our behalf, and so we're a little bit reluctant about receiving hospitality. Sometimes I think that we don't want to be beholden to somebody else. You know, if I accept your offer to loan me your lawnmower, then I am now beholden to you to loan you my chainsaw, perhaps. I don't know. But there's this little internal ledger that goes on in many of our minds, and we are afraid that we will be beholden if we accept the gifts of other people. And there is underlying all of these things, I think, the greatest challenge of all, and that is that to be on the receiving end of hospitality requires humility. It requires the openness and receptivity to the gift. We simply put ourselves in the position of being served. And that requires humility. And my hunch, correct me if I'm wrong, my hunch is that it's easier for many of us to give than it is to receive the gift of hospitality. Now, our journey in thinking about radical hospitality has taken us to the Gospel of Mark. In fact, the Gospel of Mark was my inspiration for doing this series of messages. As I read through the readings of the Gospel of Mark several months ago, I was struck by the radical hospitality of Jesus that was extended to disciples and community and the people at large around him. It was really the Gospel of Mark that inspired all of this. And so this morning, we are once again following along with Jesus and his disciples. This morning, we've followed along with Jesus to the temple courts. It is the week of the Passover, the highest week of the year in Jewish worship. Jesus and his disciples have gone to the temple courts. They are in the setting of the most extraordinary buildings in all of Israel, the beautiful temple of Herod that had been constructed years earlier, just simply the most extraordinary gift of architecture to that part of the world. Jesus is wandering around in the inner courts. We know that because he's having conversations with other men in these inner courts. This is the court of the Jews, where only the Jewish men, the ritually pure Jewish men, are welcome. He's been having a series of debates with people, the way the Jewish community loves to do. He's debated with one group of people about one issue, and he's debated with another group of people about another issue, questioning him to check out where he's coming from, various people asking their questions. And now, there is a scribe that approaches Jesus. He's listened to the responses of Jesus to various debating questions. And he says, "Rabbi, I've noticed that you answer wisely." Now, as you pay attention to this scribe who is approaching Jesus, be aware that the Gospel of Mark presents him very positively. There's no hint in the Gospel of Mark that he's testing Jesus. There's no hint here that he is looking for some accusation. Others have done that. The Gospel of Mark presents this scribe in a very positive light. He comes across as a seeker, and he says to Jesus, "Rabbi, I've noticed that you've been answering wisely. Tell me, what is the first of all of the commandments? We have hundreds of commandments in the law of Moses. What is the first of all of the commandments?" This is a very, very, very important question. You see, what we identify as central will determine how we place all of the other commandments. If the commandment about washing your hands before you eat is the most important of all of the commandments, then love will be secondary to the command of washing your hands. If the command of keeping the Sabbath is the most important one, then everything will pale compared to keeping the Sabbath. This man wants Jesus to answer, what is the guiding center of the law? And Jesus responds with these words. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 6. "The most important, the first among the commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength.' This is the first of the commandments." Jesus is identifying the love of God in everything that we do as the singular devotion of our lives. When you're at worship, love God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And when you're at work, love God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And when you're with your family, love God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. This is the singular devotion of the people of God. Love God in everything. And then, Jesus added, "There is a second that is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." Now, let's be very careful and clear about what it is that is happening here. Jesus is identifying the love of God as the central conviction of the people of God. This is our singular devotion. Do this right, and everything else will fall in place. Love God with your whole being. But there's a second commandment that is like it. And in fact, if we don't do the second commandment, we can't possibly be doing the first commandment. These two are bound so inexplicably together that to pull them apart is to do a disaster to either one of them. And the second one that must not be pulled apart from the first is this commandment from Leviticus: love your neighbor as yourself. These two are inexplicably joined. Now, we should acknowledge, by the way, Jesus was not the first one to do this. There were some of the rabbis who had identified Deuteronomy chapter 6 and Leviticus, I believe, chapter 17, as two commandments that together formed a singular whole. Jesus was not the first. He is, however, recognizing the tradition, the wisdom of this tradition, that these two things cannot be separated from one another. The scribe is listening intently to Jesus all the way through. Remember, Mark presents him to us as a seeker. His heart is open. He's listening to the words of Jesus. He recognizes that Jesus speaks from the same tradition that he himself believes in. He says, "You are right, Rabbi. You've spoken wisely. We must love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and we must love our neighbor as ourselves. Upon these two depend all of the law and the prophets, and these are more important than offering sacrifices in the temple." And then Jesus responds to him with these words. Do we have one more up there? Okay, we do not have one more up there. Jesus responds to him with these words. "You are not far from the kingdom." Now, these words are a great compliment to the scribe. They are a recognition that he understands wisely, and he's hearing well what is most important. But these words are also a challenge from Jesus. You're not far. It means you haven't entered yet. You have an understanding. You're almost on the way. You've got your foot ready to be set on the path, but now you need to pick your foot up and you need to get your foot on the path, and that path is to do the thing of which you're speaking. Love. God and neighbor, love. Now, we're talking about one side of the coin so far, and I'm going to ask you to take this coin and flip it over. Let's look at the flip side of this coin. Let's imagine, and it doesn't take much imagination, let's imagine that this scribe who is a seeker, who has heard Jesus, is compelled by the words that Jesus has spoken. You're not far from the kingdom. He hears the challenge to pick his feet up and put them on the path and to get on the adventure of love. And so as he's walking through the temple courts, away from the place where he's had this conversation with Jesus, let's imagine he comes across a neighbor of his. He knows that his neighbor's wife has been sick and he hasn't gone to visit his neighbor or his neighbor's wife thus far. And he's compelled by what he's just heard by Jesus, from Jesus. And he walks over to his neighbor and he says, "Charlie, I'm so sorry that I haven't been over to talk to you. I understand that your wife is sick. Listen, how about you guys come and celebrate the Passover meal with us this week? We'll get an extra lamb. We'll put a little extra mashed potatoes on. We'll fire up a few extra vegetables. We can do it. You guys just come join us for the Passover celebration, would you? Let us take care of it." And imagine that his friend Charlie says, "I appreciate the invitation, but we can handle it ourselves." Imagine that our scribe friend, disappointed a little bit, walks a little bit further, and he sees a friend of his that he went to school with, hasn't seen him for years. Walks over and talks to his friend Fred that he hasn't seen for years, and he realizes that he and Fred are living in the same village, didn't even know it. He and Fred are living in the same village. He says, "Fred, since we're living in the same village, why don't you come to my place for dinner? I'll mention it to my wife. We'd just love to have you over to our place for dinner. Would you come join us?" And Fred says, I don't know. I'm kind of busy. I think I've got enough friends already. To be honest, I really don't need that." And our scribe friend walks away disappointed. You see, the problem, or the beauty, depending on your perspective, of hospitality is that hospitality is a system. In order for hospitality to be given, hospitality has to be received. Love is a system. In order for love to be given, love must be received and to be returned. It is a system. We love, 1 John says, because God first loved us. Do you hear the system? The love of God is, as it were, the fertile soil and the water and the sunshine and the seed that brings life to our human loves for one another. We love because God first loved us. We love God because God first loved us. Our love for God is response to God's love for us. It is a system. It goes, it comes, and it goes. It is given, and it is returned. If it is not received, the system is broken. And our loves for one another are a system. Love given must be welcomed. Hospitality granted must be received. It's a little bit like an electric circuit. If you go home today, and a light is on in your kitchen, as happens all the time at our house. Who left the light on? And you flip the switch. You're not going to stop and think about all the stuff that's going on. You just look up and the light is out. But what has happened here is electricity requires a complete circuit. And the moment that complete circuit is broken, it's as simple as flipping a switch. The circuit is broken, electricity is no longer carried through, and you no longer have lights. And love and hospitality require a giving and a receiving. And if hospitality is broken because it is not received, the circuit is broken as well. Have you ever thought about the importance of receptivity among the disciples of Jesus? I think a pretty good case could be made that the most important characteristic of disciples of Jesus is that they are receptive. You might want to think about that and argue with me. I think a case could be made that the single most important quality of disciples of Jesus is that they are receptive. Jesus comes along one day. He invites them to follow. He invites them to be part of his community. He will serve it as the host. They cannot enter into this relationship if they are not receptive and complete the cycle. He calls them to be receptive to one another. The one thing these folks have in common, in spite of all of their differences, some of them are day laborers. One of them is a tax collector. One of them is a political zealot. Women are part of the gathering of the community of Jesus. There are some who are notorious sinners. There's one like Nicodemus who is responsive to the ministry of Jesus, who is a well-known Pharisee. All of these folks, part of the community of Jesus, the one thing that they all have in common is the capacity to receive, to be receptive to the grace of God in Jesus, to be gracious, to be open and welcoming to the hospitality of God, and to receive it and to welcome it. If they don't welcome it, the circuit is broken, and they can't be part of what God is doing in their midst. We don't often think this way, but have you ever thought about the receptivity of Jesus? We think of Jesus as the one who is constantly giving, right? He's the one who is constantly giving and constantly welcoming others. Have you ever thought about Jesus' receptivity to the hospitality of others? How many times do the Gospels present Jesus eating in somebody's home? How did that happen? Well, somebody said, Jesus, why don't you come over to my place for dinner tonight? And Jesus sometimes apparently said, could I bring some of my tax collector and sinner friends with me? Jesus again and again and again and again is accepting the invitations of people. He goes into the home of Simon Peter's mother-in-law, apparently stays there on more than one occasion, sleeps at this house, accepting the welcome and the generosity and the hospitality of others. There's going to be an incident just a couple of days later than this text that we're looking at today. While Jesus is still in Jerusalem, he's going to go into the home of a fellow by the name of Simon the leper for dinner. Already, he is receiving the hospitality of somebody else. He's going to be in the home of Simon the leper. While he's there, there's going to be a woman whose name is never named in the gospel. She's going to enter into the home of Simon the leper. While Jesus is there having dinner with others, she's going to go over to Jesus with this alabaster jar of perfume, extraordinarily expensive. And she's going to pour it on Jesus' head as an anointing. And she's going to let it run down over his hair and down over his shoulders. This extraordinarily expensive oil that she's going to pour out over the head and the shoulders of Jesus. And some of the people who are looking on are going to say, he shouldn't be letting her do this. This could have been sold and given away to the poor. And Jesus is going to say, don't stop her. What this lady is doing right now, she's preparing me for my burial. Nobody understands that other than him. He says, don't stop her. What she's doing today will be told about her forever, like today. Have you ever thought about the receptivity of Jesus? Have you ever thought about the receptivity to which he called his disciples? We've heard the stories about how Jesus sent disciples out to preach the good news in the towns and the villages. He sent them out by 70s sometimes. He told them to go out in twos. Okay, you two go to Capernaum, and you two go to Nazareth, and I want you two to go over there. And wherever you go, preach the good news of the kingdom and heal the sick and tell them about the power of resurrection and cast out demons. We've heard that part of the story. Did you ever notice that he also said, oh, by the way, when you go, don't take your wallets. Leave your credit cards behind. Leave your AAA card behind. Don't take your checking book with you, because as you go out, stay in the homes of the people who will welcome you. Eat their food. sleep in their beds, and then go out and preach the good news. What is going on here? What is going on here is that Jesus is modeling and teaching the power of shalom, the power of community that is built up when people give and receive hospitality from one another, when it is not just given, but it is also welcomed. Jesus is inviting disciples to live as people who are hosts to others and also who are willing to be hosted. Oh, you're opening your home to me? Wonderful. I guess I won't be needing Hotel 6, will I? Isn't it interesting, by the way, as a culture, we've become dependent upon things like hotels because this practice of hospitality has been to too great a degree lost to us. Well, here I was in a little community, a little rural village outside of Yangon, Myanmar, perhaps a 30-minute drive now from the city, and our host had brought us these orange sodas that I strongly suspect they may not have been able to purchase for themselves. I was horrified at the thought of what this gift cost. And apparently, the leader of our group of three, the missionary who had invited me to be part of this group of three, he must have seen my discomfort. He looked across the circle at me, and he just nodded. And to set an example, he took his bottle and he took a huge drink, and so I did as well. That was not the end of the hospitality we got. At times, friends, it was almost embarrassing the way that we were treated by these extraordinarily poor people. One day, I was going to a bus that was traveling from one church to another. It was a bus full of people, and I was carrying a suitcase with some stuff that we were going to be needing when we got to the other end of our destination, and I was getting ready to step up on this bus that the church had rented. A man jumped down off of the bus, smaller and older than me, and he took my bag, and he carried my bag up onto the bus, and as I stepped onto the bus, they insisted that I be seated while people who were older and sicker than me were standing. They insisted. When we ate meals together, the three of us were always taken to the head table, and we were the first to eat while others waited in line and ate at other tables. It was at times almost unbearable to receive this kind of hospitality. But I observed my friend John Johnson, the leader of this group, again and again and again, just nodding at me as though he understood, just nodding, yes, receive it, welcome it. But you know, something else happened on that trip as well. As we were free to receive the hospitality of these people, they were also free to receive ours. We spent days and days and days teaching and leading conferences, and we had opportunities to be with some of their leaders and to counsel and to help and to encourage. And we had the opportunity to bring money from this church and others to empower them for some of their ministries. And while we were there was a tragedy that took place. One of their pastors was killed during our time there by a ridiculous terrorist incident. And we were able to be there to counsel and to comfort and to love and to be part of the grieving process. And what I'm trying to describe for you is that the circle was completed. The circuit just went around and around and around. Hospitality given. Hospitality received. Shalom built in the community. It is certainly true that it is more blessed to give than to receive, but of this I am also absolutely certain. Unless there is a receiver who is open and willing, there cannot be a giver. Would you pray with me, please?